The Senate Judiciary Committee is convened at this moment and scheduled to vote today on Judge Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. This is after yesterday's dramatic testimony by both Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who alleges that he sexually assaulted her. On Insight today, we're going to devote the hour to reaction and analysis, starting with the political junkie Ken Rudin. We'll get his take on the hearing yesterday. We'll get the latest on what's happening with the committee vote and the role of California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. I'll also talk with experts about specifics in Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony and the impact of sexual assault. We'll explore the power of social media in this story, and then what happens next on Capitol Hill and in American politics. The midterm elections are just weeks away. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on this Insight special. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. A vote is scheduled, but whether it happens today in the Senate Judiciary Committee is a big question at this point. I'm talking about the vote on the confirmation process of U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Republican Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona has announced this morning that he will vote yes for Judge Kavanaugh. That's one of the key uncertainties that now has become known. And all of this, of course, follows that stunning hearing yesterday with public testimony from Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. She alleges that she was sexually assaulted by Judge Brett Kavanaugh when they were in high school. And Kavanaugh yesterday, with anger and emotion, said it wasn't him. He didn't do it. So let's start the hour with the political junkie Ken Rudin. He gives us history and perspective on American politics. But Ken, this is going to be its own, not only chapter, its own book, I think, of American history. Glad to have you on the program.
Well, thank you, Beth. And I think that's absolutely true. I think of, you know, you think of not only the times that we've watched TV because of politics, but we've watched TV because of news. And you think of how we were riveted during the OJ trial or how we were riveted during the Challenger explosion in 1986. I mean, we just couldn't breathe, couldn't blink, couldn't move from the TV. And of course, some people listen to radio. I understand that. But yesterday was one of those days. From Eastern time, from 10 in the morning until just before 7 p.m., that's 9 hours right there of testimony alone, plus the analysis we saw on cable and the networks afterwards. It was just remarkable, and I really don't think I moved for hours at a time, and it was just something I'll never forget, and I think it's a signature moment in the nation's political history. I know that sounds like hyperbole. I think everybody likes to think that this is always the greatest or most important or most outrageous thing they've ever seen in their life, witnessed in their life. This one is up there, absolutely.
I do want to spend time on the hearing, but for the moment, Ken, let's say that we are watching what happens on Capitol Hill right now. And I think there's a little more to add already this morning about this process of getting to a committee vote. Will you add in some of the dynamics and context?
Yeah, no, I don't think, I was listening to your introduction, I don't think there's a question whether there will be a committee vote today, and especially the fact that the one Republican who was in doubt was Jeff Flake, the retiring, and sometimes he talks a good game, the courageous senator, or not courageous senator from Arizona, who, as I said, is retiring. He does speak, like yesterday he talked about, well, there's real reason for doubt. There's complete doubt about Kavanaugh's truth. There's something about Blasey Ford's testimony that really, touched him. And I was thinking, gee whiz, maybe this will be Flake's final moment in the sun where he votes against his party, and he announced today he would not. But even if so, that means it looks like all 11 Republicans will vote yes. Matter of fact, I'm sure of that, and I don't know if all Democrats will vote no, because some Democrats may even skip the vote. I mean, right now they're still having a back and forth between Democrats and Republicans on the committee, and I think there are several members of the Senate on the Democratic side, including Kamala Harris, who are not in the hearing room. So I don't know if they plan to boycott the vote or will come and make statements and then ultimately boycott the vote. But the point is, whether Jeff Flake voted yes or no, that would not affect the nomination going to the full Senate. So even if the committee voted, let's just say Flake voted no, and it would be 11 no, 10 yes, it would go to the Senate with an unfavorable recommendation, but it would still go to the Senate where the numbers still favor the Republicans.
There was a report that, you're right, Senator Kamala Harris had walked out of the committee meeting this morning, calling the process a sham. We just heard in news reports that Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar had been vocal about the process and upset about the process. But let's say the vote does happen. It moves on to the Senate. That can unfold over the weekend. At least the beginnings of this hearing can happen on the Senate floor starting Saturday, correct?
That's correct. And I think because of some procedural votes that will still have to take place, what I'm hearing is that there probably can't be or won't be a vote in the full Senate before Monday or even Tuesday. But that's still much quicker than the Democrats would like. They're still insisting for an investigation by the FBI. The Democrats released a letter today from the president of the American Bar Association. Now, the Republicans and Kavanaugh yesterday have been citing the ABA endorsement of Kavanaugh all along. But today, the president of the ABA said there should be no vote at all until there's an FBI investigation. Of course, the Republicans and Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa said, well, that doesn't matter because the president of the ABA doesn't speak for the entire ABA, and there are thousands of lawyers who don't agree, and did this go before a committee, and so we don't care what the president of the ABA has to say. That's basically what he actually said, even though yesterday all we heard about was how much the ABA loved Brett Kavanaugh. So there's interest in the Democrats still holding out hope for an FBI investigation, but right now, with Chuck Grassley and the Republicans saying we don't need it, and of course what they've been saying, which is remarkable, is that, well, if this was so important, why didn't we have this investigation earlier? Why didn't they come forward earlier with Christine Blasey Ford's accusations? Well, that's hardly an argument for not having an investigation now. Are we saying that, well, even if he is guilty, we should have had an investigation into these charges earlier? The fact is that since there has not been a vote in the Senate yet, it's not too late for an FBI investigation, but that's not what we're hearing.
In fact, I'm seeing this morning, Ken, that four GOP governors are calling for a delay. Also on that point of an FBI investigation, governors from Massachusetts, Ohio, Maryland, and Vermont. And there was definitely that exchange, intense exchange, with Judge Kavanaugh yesterday, where he was asked to turn to Don McGahn and request an FBI investigation or go directly to the president himself. So this is a lingering issue, a lingering question. I don't know to what degree there's seriousness about somebody acting on it, but that could stop the process at any point here, couldn't it?
Yes, it could, or at least slow down the process. But we've seen from the Republicans, we've seen from the White House, we've seen no indication from anybody that there's going to be that FBI investigation. We always would go back to the 1991 Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, which was a Democratic Senate and a Republican president, George H.W. Bush. And Bush, after the Anita Hill allegations came through, Bush called for an FBI investigation, and there was one. Now, ultimately, the FBI investigation didn't make any recommendations. They didn't come up with any conclusions at all, but there was an investigation. And of course, you know, I mean, as I said, in a Democratic Senate, Clarence Thomas was approved 52-48. I thought what was most interesting about the whole thing is that when the first half of the hearing was Christine Blasey Ford testifying, and I thought, I mean, look, do I think she was credible? Absolutely. Do I think one of them, Blasey Ford or Brett Kavanaugh, is lying? Absolutely, because they're both 100% positive of what they're saying. She said it absolutely happened. He's saying it didn't. But the fact is that, one, why would she lie? Why would she put herself through such abuse and ridicule and death threats to make this point? She went to her therapist in 2012 well before there was ever a nomination to the Supreme Court, and told her therapist and told her husband that Brett Kavanaugh committed this assault back some 30 years ago. And she wrote letters to, you know, Anna Eshoo, the California congresswoman, and Dianne Feinstein, her state senator. I mean, she went to them before Kavanaugh's name was nominated. He was only like on the list, the possible list of Trump nominees. So this was not hardly an orchestrated effort by Blasey Ford to stop, to put politics into it. She told them what she wanted to say, what happened to her. And for her to, I mean, it was clearly she was scared out of her mind, and she talked about how frightened she was and why else would she come forward. Now, the other thing, I'm sorry I'm hogging up your time here, but one more thing that what really, really struck me is that when she was testifying, the Republicans, all 11 white males, all the Republicans refused to question her, refused to ask her any questions. They left it to a woman by the name of Rachel Mitchell, who was a sex crimes prosecutor from Arizona, who apparently got like one day of notice before she came in. But once she left, once that horrible woman, Christine Blasey Ford, left, and the Republicans didn't have to fear her anymore, then they unleashed this unbelievable attack on the Democrats, on Dianne Feinstein, for lying, for holding up the facts, for stalling the nomination, for leaking stuff about Blasey Ford to the press. It was an amazing spectacle. And look, am I showing my opinions here? Absolutely.
Yes.
Because you either have to, you could be an objective person and say, well, he said, she said, but given the reasons, the passion, the kind of demeanor they had, to me, there was no question that some injustice was done, because right now it looks like the committee is going to vote 11-10 to approve this nomination.
Maybe some people didn't hear the testimony yesterday. It might be worthwhile to hear a bit of each voice. And so with what you just said, I think I'll start with a short clip here from Christine Blasey Ford. And the reason I'm going to play this clip is because afterwards, a lot of people said that what helped her credibility so significantly was the vulnerability, was her honesty in saying that as much as she did remember of the story, that there were gaps, too. So let's listen.
I don't have all the answers, and I don't remember as much as I would like to. But the details that about that night that bring me here today are the ones I will never forget. They have been seared into my memory and have haunted me episodically as an adult.
So we heard in very specific detail the parts that she remembered, and she was honest and truthful about what she didn't remember, which is part of the struggle for some people in believing her story. Now I'd like to share a clip of Judge Kavanaugh and his testimony. And he came out fiery and angry and denying the accusation.
This onslaught of last-minute allegations does not ring true. I'm not questioning that Dr. Ford may have been sexually assaulted by some person in some place at some time. But I have never done this to her or to anyone. That's not who I am. It is not who I was. I am innocent of this charge.
So, Ken, do you want to say more about the testimony yesterday and perhaps the stark contrast to 1991, Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas? And I don't want this to be a history lesson, but just looking at the difference in where we've come in the span of time.
Well, actually, your last question is my favorite question. Where have we come since 1991? And the reason I ask that, because as with Anita Hill, Christine Blasey Ford came forward with no political agenda. And the fact is, as I said, she talked to her therapist and husband and named Brett Kavanaugh as the alleged assaulter back in 2012. She contacted Anna Eshoo, the California congresswoman, in July before Kavanaugh was nominated. So the lesson, once again, you wonder, you know, I posted something on social media and said, now you know why women who are assaulted don't come forward. And if you want to see, you know, why, just turn on your TV, because all the Republicans said that, you know, why'd she come out so late and why doesn't she remember how she got there to this party, this alleged party, and why doesn't she remember how she got home? If you listen to any woman who's ever been assaulted sexually or any kind of assault, these things, the memory plays tricks on you, and you forget details because of the trauma. So to question her credibility, to say, well, if it really happened, how could she not remember how she got home? And how, you know,
hey, Ken,
it's just remarkable.
Ken, I'm going to pause you because we are getting the report that there will be a vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee in about an hour and 10 minutes, 10:30 Pacific time.
Yeah, there's no question there was going to be a vote, especially with Flake saying yes, but there was going to be a vote either way. Yes.
And I don't want to put you in a position of being an expert on sexual assault survivors. I do want to go back to one point, and that is the political decision or the confidentiality decision, whatever it was, on the part of Dianne Feinstein. And Feinstein's role yesterday in speaking to each of the people testifying and her decision to hold back the letter. Can you tell me, from your position, how she navigated all of that and what this does or doesn't do to her politically? She is up for re-election in about 5 weeks.
Well, here's the thing. She was clearly the subject and the object of Republican scorn, that she, you know, she blocked everything and she manipulated this thing and she leaked everything about Blasey Ford. And I thought she gave a credible response to it. One, Blasey Ford did not want her name to come forward. And that's why every other Republican is saying, well, why didn't we know about this in July? And why didn't we know about Blasey Ford? And Feinstein said over and over again that, I'll tell you why, because she asked me not to do it. And she also emphatically denied that anybody on her staff or Feinstein herself, released these documents, released this information. And so I think she handled herself well. I think as far as her, I mean, look, I know she's up for re-election against a Democrat challenging her from the left in 5 weeks, and I don't see this hurting her at all. I think her statements on behalf of Blasey Ford were very emotional and thorough. And I think, I hate to talk about Kavanaugh versus Blasey Ford as a political issue, but it's become a political issue around the country. Republicans say you vote for him, Democrats saying you don't.
A lot of sexual assault survivors felt that it was much more of a political issue yesterday than an issue about what Dr. Blasey Ford might have experienced or what the impact of sexual assault was. We're actually going to talk about that more in our next segment. But I'm kind of torn here whether we should listen to Feinstein talking to Blasey Ford or whether I should skip ahead to a moment. I think I want to know this, Ken. Did you see the picture that was posted on Twitter that is supposed to be Brett Kavanaugh watching the testimony, that an aide says that he was, in fact, watching the testimony of Dr. Ford? And I bring that up because the other California Senator, Kamala Harris, had asked him in the hearing if he had watched the testimony, and he said no.
Well, that is news to me. I remember Kamala Harris asking the question, and I thought that was very instructive. How could you not be listening to 3 hours of testimony about a woman who's accusing you of a horrific crime? And I did not see this photo, no. So that's,
I've not been able
to. There were so many questions. Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democrat from Rhode Island, talked about, look, these untruths, alleged untruths by Brett Kavanaugh, are not only about Blasey Ford. It's about the questions he were asked about his role in the Kenneth Starr investigation, his role in the Bush White House. So part of the Democratic argument, and that was there even before Blasey Ford came forward, is that he has not been completely truthful. I have not seen this photo, and that's if it's true, it's a stupid lie. And I think, I mean, if I were Kavanaugh's defense counsel yesterday, I would have suggested an approach completely different, more contrition, more sympathy for Blasey Ford, and more insistence that he didn't do it, as opposed to the belligerence, the accusations that it's a left-wing plot, that people who are angry about the Trump election are out to get me, that it's the Clintons. I mean, it was just remarkable.
Well, that photo, that tweet that I cited, it's unverified by our newsroom, and I just wondered whether you had seen it. Perhaps you were another source on it. So I kind of leave that out there, open to some fact-checking and verification right now.
And let me just say, Ed, one thing that I, you know, Jeff Flake voting yes is the was one of the big news of this morning. The fact that Joe Donnelly, the very vulnerable Democrat from Indiana, who voted yes on Neil Gorsuch, said he will vote no on Kavanaugh. So that's interesting as well.
All right.
That's not in the committee. That's on the Senate floor.
We're going to go to a break. We're going to continue our show talking a little bit more about this issue of sexual assault survivors, some of the behaviors and responses to the trauma. But Ken, if you'll stand by, we'll come back around to you at the end of the hour and we'll see if anything transpires between now and then, okay?
Thank you so much, Beth. I'll be listening to every word you do.
Thank you, Ken. Ken Rudin is the political junkie. He usually joins us on Monday. So besides the end of this hour, we will talk with him again in a few days. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford testified yesterday that the sexual assault she experienced, quote, drastically altered her life, that she especially struggled in the 4 years after the event. She struggled academically and socially in relationships, and that the reality of coming forward with her story has been, quote, far worse than she expected. We're going to spend a bit of time exploring the aspect of sexual assault survivors and the telling or the not telling, and when do you tell and who do you tell of what happened. On the phone with me is Beth Hassett. She is CEO of the Sacramento nonprofit WEAVE, which is Women Escaping a Violent Environment. Hi, Beth. Glad to have you on the program today.
Thanks for including me.
In the studio with me is John Finley, Public Policy Associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and we have some of the statement that CalCASA put out yesterday. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Also in the studio is Maggie Krell, Chief Legal Counsel to Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California. Maggie, I'm glad to have you here as well. I should add that you have a prosecutor's background in all of this, so I know you were looking at this from multiple views. Beth, let me start by asking you about the testimony yesterday and the comparison to women who have come out of domestic violence situations, abuse situations, and how true Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony rang for the many years of experience you have with women, or I should say abuse survivors, whether they be men or women.
You know, her testimony was very compelling and exactly the type of thing we hear, especially from somebody who is reporting a sexual assault late. Memories fade, and when somebody's experiencing any kind of trauma, memories are discombobulated, and the way the brain processes that traumatic event doesn't always come out in a testimony that sounds like it was written in a textbook. And I feel for her, and we've heard her type of story so many times at WEAVE with the sexual assault victims that we serve.
John, in that statement by CalCASA, it's written that Dr. Ford's preference for confidentiality and privacy was breached. There was a lot of politics involved in the statement coming forward. But what do you see about her being in that national and to some degree international spotlight yesterday and the fact that she did say and do what she did.
Well, first of all, I think Dr. Ford testified and felt that it was her civic duty to appear before that committee.
She said that.
Having the information that she had, the experience and trauma that she carried at the hands of Judge Kavanaugh, she felt it was her duty to come forward and present that information to the committee. In her testimony, I don't believe Dr. Ford ever said the words, Brett Kavanaugh should not be a Supreme Court justice. What she did was tell her story, feel that her story was relevant to the character evaluations of Brett Kavanaugh that the United States Senate Judiciary Committee was making, and felt that she had to tell that to somebody. She could not hold it on just to herself in the context of him being about to be promoted to the Supreme Court for life. And so her request for confidentiality and privacy rings true for so many survivors, namely because the biggest concern that survivors have coming forward with a story is that they'll get exactly the type of response Dr. Ford got, which is outright rejection, public shaming, people disbelieving and minimizing her story. And I think she was right to feel afraid that that would happen, because that's exactly the response she received and that so many survivors receive when they do come forward publicly, especially against somebody who carries so much power and influence as Brett Kavanaugh. But she really, I thought, was tremendously brave in telling that story. I think her strength gave the country strength in telling that, in telling it to the faces of the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, I thought was extraordinary.
Maggie, I'm going to get to you in a moment. Beth, do you think yesterday encouraged or discouraged women to want to tell their stories?
You know, I think it did both of those things. I think it could have a chilling effect on victims who are already reticent about coming forward and fear all of these same things happening to them in a smaller playing field. But I also think that it gives strength to a lot of people who can see that a successful woman is still being that brave, coming forward, stepping into that spotlight, however unenthusiastically. And I think that it will give people hope that people will believe them. And it started a dialogue in our society that I think is very important. It's important that we talk about these things in a very public way so that we are showing our support publicly for survivors.
Maggie, tell me how you listened to the testimony yesterday. Did you have more the ears of a prosecutor, an investigator, or were you listening in the spirit of women coming forward, needing help, needing to be heard?
You know, frankly, it was all of that. And as a prosecutor, I'll tell you, because we've talked a lot about Dr. Ford's testimony already, I thought it was incredibly compelling, credible. She is a profile in courage. But turning to Judge Kavanaugh, and again, this isn't a trial. This is really a job interview. It's about whether or not this man has the integrity, the character, the intellect to be on the highest court in the land. And he certainly has the intellect. But just seeing him react and seeing how suspects often react on the witness stand, it's not unusual for suspects to deny allegations like this. And we have women all around the country who are underreporting incidents like this. We have 7 out of 10 sexual assault victims don't come forward, don't report. So we have a crisis with underreporting, but we don't have a crisis with suspects who say, I didn't do it. So as I saw him on, you know, testifying for his job, and he seemed to have this righteous indignation that he boiled up, but he was really pointing fingers at everyone. He seemed very angry, very belligerent, almost abusive towards the Democratic senators. And then, you know, perfect gentleman, of course, when the Republicans on the committee were asking him questions. He didn't seem credible to me.
Same question I asked Beth. Cases need survivors, witnesses, victims to come forward and testify. What impact do you think yesterday had, from whichever perspective you're looking at it, in terms of people who need to tell their story being willing to come forward?
I agree with Beth's answer on that. I mean, I think it's, of course, Dr. Ford has been subjected to death threats and her life has been completely upended by this. And I think it will explain why so many women don't report. But at the same time, seeing her courage and seeing that model of courage gives me hope that it will help other women see that you can be successful, that you can have a full and successful life after something traumatic happens, and that, yes, you can tell your story. But I think it's absolutely essential that you be able to tell your story when you want to on your own timeline, that if you want to tell no one at all, that you shouldn't be obligated to do so. And, you know, Senator Feinstein, who's really taken the brunt of the attacks here, really honored Dr. Ford's choice to remain anonymous. And then when it got leaked and Dr. Ford decided, since she was going to be pushed into the public spotlight anyways, to tell her story her way rather than having it, you know, be told by others in a different way, she came forward. But Senator Feinstein really honored the survivor's choice in this situation.
We do have a bit of Dr. Blasey Ford talking yesterday about wanting to come forward earlier. And I think we have that piece of tape. It is from the hearing. She's talking about what her intention was.
My original intent was to get the information when there was still a list of other candidates available. And once that was not successful, and I saw that persons were very supportive of the nominee, I tracked it all summer and realized that when I was calculating that risk-benefit ratio, that it looked like I was going to just, you know, suffer only for no reason.
There can be a lot of gauging that goes on in figuring out what to say and when. I am talking with, and you just heard, Maggie Krell, Chief Legal Counsel to Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California. Beth Hassett, CEO of the Sacramento nonprofit Weave, is joining us by phone. And in the studio also is John Finley, Public Policy Associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Tell me about some of the challenges in creating policy to support victims coming forward. And we're certainly seeing that play out right now in the Me Too movement across the country and the We Said Enough campaign, which is about to turn 1 year old in just a few weeks. What about those hurdles, John?
I think the biggest challenge is in culture. It's in the culture of politics, in the folks who become policymakers and get elected to office, the callousness that they express towards victims of sexual assault, towards survivors of any form of sexual violence. We saw that on full display in the committee hearing yesterday, how the majority party in the United States Senate expressed so much camaraderie with Brett Kavanaugh and wouldn't even speak to Dr. Ford, hired a prosecutor to come in and ask questions of Dr. Ford, but had no words to say directly to her themselves. They had plenty of apology, plenty of defense, plenty of buddy-buddy chit-chat with Brett Kavanaugh.
Would you have preferred that the Republican senators do question her and engage her directly?
The only reason I wouldn't have preferred that is because I can't trust that they'd be respectful to her. And that is indicative of exactly the kind of cultural problem that we face in trying to craft policy that is responsive to the needs of survivors.
Their position was that they were being respectful by choosing this independent prosecutor and honoring her 5-minute time limit, which got everybody into a kind of a bizarre format yesterday.
Right. I thought it was telling that they abandoned that procedure once Brett Kavanaugh came in the room and felt perfectly comfortable speaking to him directly.
Beth, can I ask you about that format and about the issue of talking with and questioning people who have experienced abuse or trauma? Do you have an opinion about that whole point that was being made?
You know, I think it's really unfortunate that they turned it into something that felt much more like a trial or an inquisition rather than a conversation and, you know, kind of bowed out and put a woman up front to ask the survivor questions. The whole thing and the way it flowed was very bizarre and choppy, and it can't have felt good to her to have them kind of hiding behind this spokesperson that they identified.
And what happens now to Christine Blasey Ford? The hearing is done. She, unless there's an FBI investigation or charges pressed, she goes back to her life, which can never be the same life again. What's ahead for her?
Well, the thing I worry about, any survivor of sexual assault is on a path towards healing that is very nonlinear. we know that there are ups and downs, and she's clearly invested in having therapy and doing work on herself to move past it. I can't imagine what wounds are going to be reopened and new wounds from the way she's been treated and now this fear of people coming and harassing her and her family. I worry for her, and I hope she has a good support system around her and gets that support to heal going forward.
Obviously, this part of the conversation is focusing more on Dr. Ford and the story that she came forward with yesterday. I do want to ask you, Maggie, as chief legal counsel to Planned Parenthood affiliates, about the conversation that is out there with the possibility of Brett Kavanaugh being moved from federal judge to perhaps a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, and what the future looks like with that conservative judge and the discussion of the future of Roe v. Wade.
Certainly. And Planned Parenthood had concerns before yesterday's testimony and before these allegations came out. Judge Kavanaugh showed yesterday and throughout his career really a disdain towards women's reproductive rights and the rights of women to have autonomy over their bodies. And as he is replacing Justice Kennedy, who was a swing voter on the court. So it really shifts the court from, you know, a close 5-4 balance to a close 5-4 balance the other way.
So at this point, we are expecting a vote in about, well, less than 40 minutes from the Senate Judiciary Committee. And assuming he is confirmed in this committee, the vote would move to the full Senate floor over the weekend. I do want all of you to focus us back on California and to people here who might not only be listening but be in need in some way. And John, for that point, there's always a list of resources. What else do you say to survivors of any sexual assault, trauma, and experience who might be on real uncertain ground at the moment about what they heard and what's happened in their own life?
I would say to survivors that you're not alone. There is a community of survivors that have come forward. The Me Too movement is about creating a space where survivors can feel heard, feel a community, feel like people are going to be on their side and are going to believe their story and respect their story. Those are two separate things, I think, believing and respecting. I think a lot of people believed Dr. Ford. People didn't respect Dr. Ford in that hearing yesterday. And so survivors in California, I hope they also know that our representatives and our leaders will take their story seriously, will respect confidentiality, and hopefully we can trust our neighbors to value our stories and value our existence and our dignity as people. That's what I would hope for. And to the extent that's not true, it's on the rest of us to make that space for survivors and create that world where people can come forward, feel respected, and know that their story is going to be listened to.
Thank you, John. John Finley is Public Policy Associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Maggie, also to you, what kind of outreach is available for women here in this region who may need help right now?
Planned Parenthood stands with survivors. We have 106 health centers here in California. We plan to keep our doors open. We treat patients every day who have been sexually assaulted and who have suffered sexual abuse and domestic violence. We'll continue to do that. We'll continue to keep our doors open and to stand with survivors.
Thank you. That is Maggie Krell, Chief Legal Counsel to Planned Parenthood Affiliates of California. And Beth, to those women or men who might have felt after yesterday, I need to go back farther into the shadows or more into a secret and hidden place, what would you say?
I'd say that there is support for you. There's counseling that's free. There's legal assistance if you need it. We can provide housing. There's a whole team of people at Weave and at sister agencies throughout the state that are available, and it's all free. It's all very personalized support, whether you feel comfortable going forward or whether you just need that support and healing from that past pain. but I urge everyone to get that help, because it, not addressing what's going on and allowing it to fester just leads to more trauma. So I am very excited that you put us particularly together, because we each represent a different part of the healing process and of making things equitable and safe for survivors in our state and in our region. And I think it's important that you brought our voices together as a part of this story. So thank you.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Beth. That's Beth Hassett, CEO of the Sacramento nonprofit Women Escaping a Violent Environment, which you might know as WEAVE. We will post links to each of the organizations related to the guests, so you can find that at capradio.org/insight. And again, I thank you all for the conversation today. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A vote, the first vote, actually, in the confirmation process of Judge Brett Kavanaugh is expected in about 42 minutes if the schedule holds. We'll keep you apprised of that. And of course, you can follow the continuing news throughout the day on Cap Radio. If you've been with us, you just heard reference to the We Said Enough movement in California, part of the bigger Me Too movement. And that's where you might know the name Pamela Lopez. She was one of the first women in California to step forward and sign a letter that was published almost a year ago, alleging and describing some of the sexual abuse and sexual assault that they believed was happening at the state capitol. Pamela Lopez is now with Work Equity, and I thought it was important to have her voice in this conversation. So, Pamela, good to talk to you again. Thanks for making time for Insight today.
Thank you, Beth.
Tell me what the power for you is in the hearing that happened yesterday and Dr. Blasey Ford stepping forward in this confirmation process with her testimony.
The most powerful moment for me was hearing Dr. Blasey Ford say that she was afraid to come forward, but that she was motivated by her civic duty to overcome her fear and speak because the Senate Judiciary Committee had asked her to, as a character witness, really, so that they, as lawmakers, could do a thorough job of evaluating whether or not it's appropriate to have Kavanaugh be a member of the Supreme Court.
In this past year, since the initiation of the We Said Enough movement, has there been notable progress in your view? I know it's been debated by a lot of women, a lot of lawmakers, whether there's been enough, but has there been? And what did the hearing yesterday do for the effort here in California?
Well, I think that there's been amazing progress among women and even a few men who are survivors of sexual harassment and sexual assault with regard to organizing ourselves and empowering ourselves so that we have the tools necessary to stand up and speak out and fight back on our own behalf. I formed an organization shortly after saying Me Too and sharing my story called Work Equity. And over the past year, myself and the board members of Work Equity have met with women throughout the state of California and are even beginning to meet with and work with women throughout the nation who are attempting to organize themselves around shared experiences of sexual harassment or sexual assault at the hands of one powerful man, or around shared experiences within one industry, restaurant workers, for example, with whom we're working in Oakland. And that organization is organic. They found one another and they said, we don't know what we want to do, but we want to do something.
And that networking is creating an opportunity for the sister organizations that Work Equity partners with to come in with resources, like the resources that are available at Planned Parenthood, like the resources that are available at WEAVE or Equal Rights Advocates or the California Employment Lawyers Association, and teach those resources to this natural, organic network of survivors that will be prepared to stand up for ourselves now, but that will also be prepared to stand up for ourselves and support ourselves in the inevitable backlash that will occur following this Me Too moment. And that backlash will come, and that's why it's so important for survivors to be connected now and have resources now so that we can support one another during the dark times and the hard times ahead.
Pamela, our time is short, but I have one more question. What do you make of Dr. Blasey Ford being 100% sure that Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her, and Brett Kavanaugh being 100% sure that he didn't do it?
She's telling the truth, and he's lying. Her testimony was so credible and so believable, and survivors do not make these moments up. There is no reason other than being propelled by her sense of civic duty that Dr. Blasey Ford would have any reason to fabricate something. This has been difficult for her, I know, but I'm sure she has the prescience to know that this will continue to be difficult for her for many years and that she will bear the cross of stepping forward for many years. She's committed an act of bravery, and there's no reason other than feeling like she should share with lawmakers what she knows about the character of this man, that she would do this.
Pamela, I'm always appreciative of your time on Insight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Beth.
That is Pamela Lopez of Work Equity. We're going to take a break. We have a little bit more still ahead in this hour. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A quick finish now to this hour of focus and reaction and analysis of not only the testimony yesterday by Dr. Blasey Ford and Judge Brett Kavanaugh, but the hearing process and the vote that's anticipated today. On the phone with me is UC Davis journalism professor Andy Jones, who tracks social media and also college students. Professor Jones, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Beth. Nice to speak to you this morning.
And Ken Rudin, the political junkie, is standing by to wrap up the show, too. Ken, you're still there, correct?
I am, Beth. Thank you.
Okay. So, Professor Jones, what are college kids saying about this and the powerful role that social media has had in this story?
My students in person are outraged that the sexual assault allegations coming from Dr. Ford have not put a kibosh on this whole process. They can't understand why this credible woman's voice is not being honored and why that seems not to be changing the votes of Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. I'd say on social media, in my tracking of the different conversations, I've noticed really how polarized we are as a nation. People turn to social media increasingly to hear the voices of people who agree with them. And so the bifurcated hearings that we heard yesterday really reflect the bifurcated approach to this particular topic, what people are emphasizing on social media, what they're believing, and how they feel that their representatives should vote. Really, partisan politics has guided the responses and reactions and opinions of so many people on social media that increasingly, at least on Twitter, from what I saw yesterday, it's less a place of conversation and more a place of just confirmation of one's preordained views and narratives.
I think you're right in reflecting that you could feel our country holding its breath, taking a deep breath, sitting forward, leaning back. Somehow we were all moving and screaming or crying about it on social media. Ken, all of that is leading up to the first step, which is a vote in about 30 minutes or so. What's likely to happen for Judge Kavanaugh at this point?
Well, let me just say quickly about, I agree about the preordained opinions you see on Twitter. We're seeing that in the Senate as well. Right now, just a few minutes ago, Cory Booker, the Democrat from New Jersey, gave an impassioned defense of Dianne Feinstein, given the attacks on Feinstein yesterday from the Democrats, saying that she serves with decency and respect, and she's not motivated by politics. And I think that's the feeling. What I loved about your show so far, though, is that does this give a lesson to women? Does it tell women that they should come forward and they will be heard? Or if the Senate votes in favor of Kavanaugh as a judge, does it mean it's all for naught? The news in the last few minutes is that John Tester, another Democrat in a deep red state who's up for re-election this year, announced he will vote no on the floor of the Senate. I said earlier that Joe Donnelly of Indiana is going to vote no. Donnelly did vote for Neil Gorsuch last year. He's going to vote no this year. So that's what seems to be happening. All eyes seem to be left. What's left is that Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, the two pro-abortion rights Republicans who have not announced how they'll vote, that is key. If they vote no, the nomination is defeated on the floor of the Senate. If one of them only votes yes.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and UC Davis professor Andy Jones. More at capradio.org. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Beth.